hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fog and dying deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of a living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You running down my country, man. You walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life. Fighting in a fog and dying deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you run down my country, man. You walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. Here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, with lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you, and you may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, you know, there's some a lot of encouraging little acts of resistance that I keep seeing across this great dominion, little acts of people fighting back or letting the collaborationist system that is replacing them know that they're not happy. Well, here's the latest, and the results are almost predictable. Let me just suppress this sound for a moment. Hateful package sent to Quebec City Mosque where 6 Muslims were killed. Now, this was way back in January where the shooting occurred, and it's not the same thing. A package containing a defaced Quran and a note expressing hate toward the Muslim cemetery project has stoked renewed fears at a Quebec mosque where 6 men were killed in January, the mosque secretary general said on Wednesday. Okay, have to be careful with that word hate. Is it really hate? Well, let's read more carefully. Mahadine Djamai said when the parcel arrived Friday, he expected it to contain more of the sympathy cards that had poured in from across Canada since the shooting. Instead, he said it contained a Koran that had been slashed and a note suggesting the Quebec City Mosque should use a pig farm as a cemetery. I was shocked, Djamai said in a telephone interview. Well, come on. So somebody doesn't like the idea of a special cemetery for Muslims. That's an opinion. I thought, again, we're getting this kind of message we didn't expect at all. It reminds us that there's always a fear that a terrible event like what happened on January 29th could happen again. Quebec Premier Philippe Couillard condemned the incident, describing it as unacceptable and repulsive. It's hard to prevent the darker side of human nature, Couillard said in Edmonton as he attended a meeting of the country's premiers. It's a repulsive act done by a coward, essentially, and should be condemned and rejected. And it's rejected by the majority of Quebecers. Well, I don't know. Did he ask them? Well, of course not. He's going to run his mouth. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the incident has nothing to do with Quebec or Canadian values. In any society, there will be people who are intolerant or racist, and I think the challenge of a strong society is to spend our time focusing on where we are similar and not where we are different, Trudeau said in Quebec City. We consider it to be an attack that is outside our values and our way of living. What else? Who else got into the act here? The package arrived 2 days before a referendum on a proposed Muslim cemetery was held on Sunday in Saint-Apollinaire, about 35 kilometers from Quebec City. That's about 20 miles. DGMI said the mosque informed police about the package but decided not to go public until after the referendum to avoid influencing the vote. A zoning change that would allow the burial ground project to move forward was rejected by 19 votes to 16. Good for them. Trudeau expresses disappointment with the referendum outcome. Certainly, I'm pleased to see that various authorities are looking to move forward and ensure discrimination doesn't happen, that people who are proud Quebecers, proud Canadians, who also happen to be Muslims, will have a capacity to bury their loved ones in their country, he said. It goes on and on. Quebec City Police spokesman David Poitras said security been increased around the Centre Culturel Islamique de Québec mosque, and that authorities were taking the matter of the package seriously. He added it was too late to know whether charge it's too soon to know whether charges will be laid. This is not the first hateful gesture toward the mosque. In June 2016, a pig's head was left at its entrance during Ramadan. The pig's head was wrapped in paper and was accompanied by a note that read, "Bon appétit." The mosque said it received hateful letters since the attack. Well, you mean opposing them? That's not the same thing as hate. Well, not all the people respond to this news item took the politically correct point of view. Sean Short wrote, "Maybe if they openly denounce and discredit the imams who call for the death of infidels, we could believe their sincerity as a religion of peace. Perhaps if they signed up with allied forces to defeat ISIS, the Taliban, etc." Let's see, what else? Anybody else have anything interesting to say? Let's see. Well, okay, then there are some various other points of view, but I find that kind of interesting, and I think this is another one of those little acts of resistance, and they're much to be cherished. You have to read through the official description to find out it's not quite what they would tell you, and you're a message of hate. No, it's a message of we're not happy with what's being imposed upon us. I'm going to try to find why we're getting this sound blowback. We may not be able to halt it directly. Well, now this is music. Don't think this is music we'd ask for either, but okay, now I have found it, and we will not have this anymore. Well, that was one act in Quebec, and predictably, the politically correct, the premier of the province, Couillon, and the trust fund kid, the ones responsible for a part they're responsible for the immigration policy to bring these people, many of whom are not, many Canadians are not happy about them. Well, there's a town in rural Quebec called Saguenay, and I was informed yesterday that Saguenay is actually an Indian word, although it sounds French, this is from La Presse. This is a major newspaper in Montreal, and it's about an incident that occurred yesterday. L'affiche Saguenay Ville Blanche réapparaît près du cimetière municipal, and there's a sign called on the outside of the town of Saguenay in rural Quebec, saying the town of Saguenay, something to the effect that welcomes you. Well, somebody hung they didn't even deface the main sign, just hung another banner over it, sign containing the word Saguenay, a white town, was placed outside a cemetery in Saguenay. It's at Saint-Honoré, and this was on Monday, this sign was placed there, and I see this as another act of resistance. People are fed up with an invasion that is replacing them. And I cannot speak on behalf of the letter of the person who did up the sign, because apparently it's anonymous. Nonetheless, it's one more, I think, very encouraging little act of resistance to the invasion. And of course, it duly received, as you might expect, condemnation by the usual suspects. And I want to try to read that to you. This computer is exceedingly slow today. Still trying to get that for you. I believe the premier weighed in to denounce it, as you might expect. This is what you expect of what I believe is an establishment in disarray. Any little act of opposition is immediately condemned. I think it's particularly insolent for politicians to condemn the expressions of people. After all, we are the people. They're supposed to serve us. Now, of course, that's not the way they see it. They see themselves really in the roles of our masters. Now, the Saguenay is a city in the Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean area, region of Quebec. It's on the Saguenay River. It's about 200 miles north of Quebec City, and it was almost solidly white and French area. And I am going to again try to get you some of the reactions to this. Encouraging little. Here we are. Two separate incidents in Quebec of xenophobic symbols being posted in public places caught the eye of local authorities. In Saint-Honoré, Quebec, a wooden sign bearing the word Saguenay, White City, in French, appeared overnight at the entrance to a cemetery that could offer burial grounds to the Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean region's Muslim community. And in Sherbrooke, Quebec, anti-immigration stickers have appeared in the city's downtown. Saint-Honoré Mayor Bruno Tremblay told CBC News the sign near the cemetery was unacceptable. He said he was having breakfast at a local diner when other patrons informed him about the sign because they were concerned. "I found it very xenophobic," he said. "We're having it taken down later. I've sent one of our guys from Public Works. In 2017, we need to be more open-minded than that." Oh, I see. So maybe when your grandchildren are the last white people in the area, maybe they will think differently of the way they were betrayed by their own grandfather. He ended up taking it down himself. The Saguenay Lac Saint Jean Islamic Association had taken steps to have part of the cemetery designated according to Muslim burial traditions in 2015, but nothing came of it. The association announced in February, following the attack on the Quebec mosque that left six members dead, that it was reviewing its efforts to find a Muslim burial ground. In Sherbrooke. Meanwhile, in Sherbrooke, stickers were distributed by the Fédération de Québécois de Souche. That's old stock Quebecers. They will not silence us, and minorities in our land never. The Federation was founded in 2007 in the middle of Quebec's a reasonable accommodation crisis. Now the group opposes mass immigration, according to Rémi Tremblay, the group's president. A student association responded to the stickers by distributing its own, denouncing racism and Islamophobia. Those stickers make them feel like they're not welcome, or make them feel fear, said University of the Quebec, University de Sherbrooke student Aude Sophie Bombardier. Sherbrooke police confirmed they are aware of the anti-immigration stickers and will continue monitoring the situation. Well, posting the stickers on public property is not permitted. The message itself isn't considered hate speech. Oh, that's good, I guess. We studied the case, and with the information we have, we cannot consider it from a criminal perspective, said Samuel Ducharme, a spokesman for the Sherbrooke police. Very good. And of course, the referendum in a small rural area also turned down a Muslim cemetery because the local residents did have a say. Oh my gosh, isn't that remarkable that people actually get to have a say? These are, I find, really encouraging little acts of resistance. And you know, this is something I think every one of us should do. You know, whether we're in the United States or Canada, we should look and see how, in whatever small way we can fight back against the immigration invasion. Number one, we never asked for it, at least not in Canada, and I know that's the case in the United States. When they changed the immigration laws in 1965 in both our countries, it was never explained to people. In fact, in the United States, a few very perceptive United States senators did bring up the issue. Well, wouldn't this take jobs away from Americans? Oh, no. The advocate, who later died of brain cancer, that was Senator Kennedy, said. Well, a few even more perceptive asked, well, might this not, over time, change the racial makeup of the population? Oh, no, just be a small number of people. Well, as you know, 1965 was a long time ago. It's actually over 50 years ago. Well, what has been the result in both Canada and the United States? Well, massive changes of the racial makeup of our country. And what points, in my opinion, to the chronic bad faith of the political class, I mean the people who promoted this, was, as it became obvious, that there would be fundamental changes in the makeup of the country, that they never recanted. They never said, oh, geez, we got it wrong, sorry, as a matter of fact, and change the law. I mean, you could perhaps make an argument that they never expected that the numbers would be there, the numbers and the makeup. I think many thought that there, at least to the extent you can read between the lines at the time, some may have thought there will be only very high quality immigrants from the third world will come in. There'll be very few and will not make much of a change.
I don't believe the people who brought forth this law thought of it that way, these changes. I don't think that was ever what they had in mind. But it may be that some of the people who acquiesced thought it's no big deal. And perhaps if the numbers had been very, very small, it might not have been a big deal. But the numbers, of course, were not small. And as that pattern became obvious, that's where, you know, you begin to see the chronic bad faith of the whole situation, where it was an immigration, it was a population change, a demographic replacement of the European founding settler people. That's what was afoot. That's what the plan was, and that's what the reality is. Well, if that was not the plan, then as the reality becomes clear, why would the proponents not make changes or rescind the law? Well, the answer is, of course, that that was precisely what their plan had been. The replacement of the European founding settler people of Canada and the United States. That was the plan, and had been all along. It would take some years before people began to, or a lot of people began to understand. And even today, it's a topic that is difficult to discuss, because the politically correct really would hope that we will not notice it until the replacement is beyond recall. And that's the battle we're in. Here's an interesting comment. This is called Going Gone, Our Beloved America at the Crossroads. And hope you'll enjoy this, and I hope I have better luck at playing this than I have one of the other things. This is going, America at the Crossroads. The wars between Trump, the media, the deep state, and the Progressive Party. This has just suddenly disappeared on me. The war between Trump, the media, the deep state, and the Progressive Party, replete with changes and countercharges of scandal, collusion, and corruption, are merely symptoms of a much larger fundamental and growing divide between Americans that's reaching a dangerous climax. On four prior occasions in American history, the country nearly split apart, as seemingly irreconcilable cultural, economic, political, social, geographical, and demographical fault lines opened a path to hatred and violence. During the Jacksonian Revolution of the 1830s, factions nearly ripped the country apart over whether the East Coast founders' establishment of a half century would relinquish its monopoly of political power to reflect the new demographic realities of an expanding frontier, and its populist champions often deemed unfit for self-governance. For the most part, the Jacksonians won. Three decades later, the nation divided over slavery, prompting the most lethal war in American history to end it and forced the defeat. The defeated Confederate states back into the Union. The Great Depression and the established and the establishment's inept response to it left a quarter of the country unemployed for nearly a decade, hungry and desperate to expand government, even if it entailed curtailing liberty in a way never envisioned by the founders. The result was eventually the redefinition of freedom as the right of the individual to have his daily needs guaranteed by the state. In the 1960s, the hippie movement, fueled by furor over the Vietnam War, civil rights protests, and environmental activism, turned holistic in a fashion rarely seen before. A quarter of a century, I'm sorry, this keeps bouncing around on my screen here, and I know it's very annoying to try to listen to what seems to be a fractured account. A quarter of a century this is before its news. There we are again. A quarter of a century, a quarter of the country went hip, grooming, dressing, and talking, and acting in a way that reflected their disdain for the silent majority of strained or irrelevant traditional America. The hipsters lost the battle. Most eventually cut their hair and outgrew their paisley tops to join the rat race, but won the war, as the universities, media, foundations, Hollywood, arts, and entertainment now echo the values of 1969 rather than those that preceded it. Now we are engaged in yet a fifth revolutionary divide, similar to but often unlike prior upheavals. The consequences of globalization, the growth of the deep state, changing demographics, open borders, the rise of geographic apartheid between the blue and the red states, and the institutionalization of permanent coastal political and cultural elite, and the reaction to all that, are tearing the country apart. Despite its 21st century veneer, the nature of the divide is often over ancient questions of politics and society. Technological advances, the entrance of a billion Chinese into the global workforce, and the huge growth in the administrative entitlement state have redefined material want. The poor today have access to appurtenances undreamed of just five decades ago by the upper classes. We have again lost this screen. I must apologize. One or two dependable cars, these are what even the poor have. Big screen television, designer sneakers and jeans, and an array of appliances from air conditioning to microwave ovens. The rub is not that IKEA has no stereo system, but that it does not have the same model that's in the rich man's Lexus. Inequality does not mean starvation. Obesity is now a national epidemic among the nation's poor. One in four Californians admitted for any reason to a hospital is found to suffer from diabetes or similar high blood sugar maladies due largely to an unhealthy diet and lifestyle choices. In political terms, the conflict hinges on whether the powers of entrenched government will be used to ensure a rough equality of result at the expense of personal liberty and free will. The old argument that a wealthy entrepreneurial class, if left free of burdensome and unnecessary government restrictions to create wealth, will enrich all Americans, is now largely discredited. Or rather, it is stranger than that. The hyper-wealthy, a Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, or Warren Buffett, by brilliant marketing and opportunistic politics, are mostly immune from government audit and from robber baron and antitrust backlash. Instead, redistributive ire is aimed at the upper middle class, which lacks the influence and romance of the extremely wealthy and is shrinking because of the higher taxes, ever-increasing regulations, and globalized trade. It does not matter that the ossified European social model does not work and leads collective decline in the standard of living. The world knows that from seeing the implosion of Venezuela and Cuba, or the gradual decline of the European Union and the wreckage of its Mediterranean members, or the plight of blue states such as Illinois and California. Instead, it's the near-religious idea of egalitarianism that counts. On the global stage, it has all but won the war against liberty. We're all creatures of the animal farm barnyard now. Indeed, if today's student actually read Orwell's short allegorical novel, perhaps unlikely because it was written by a white male heterosexual, he would miss the message and instead probably approve of the various machinations of the zealot Pig Napoleon to do whatever he deemed necessary to end the old regime, even if it meant recreating it under a new correct veneer. The conservative effort to roll back the entitlement, bureaucratic, and redistributionist state has so far mostly failed. That today, coming off sequestration, we are on target to run up $700 billion annual deficit on top of a $20 trillion national debt. That goes largely unnoticed. $18 trillion in national debt later, Ronald Reagan's idea of cutting taxes to starve the beast of federal spending has been superseded by gorge the beast to ensure that taxes rise on the upper classes. To the degree that there is a residual war over entitlements, it's not over cutting back such unsustainable programs, but instead about modestly pruning the level of annual increases. That's the level of increase. The government necessary to encroach to ensure such continued state borrowings and spending is now nearly autonomous and transcends politics and is eager to use its formidable powers against any who threaten it. On a second front, there is a veritable civil war over race, ethnicity, gender, and identity, massive immigration, the rise of opportunistic identity politics, and a new tribalism has replaced the old melting pot of assimilation, integration. The only obstacle to tribal state is that there may soon be too many victims with too many claims over too few oppressors. There are too many incentives, from political spoils and university admissions to government employment and popular cultural acceptance, to identify with one's tribe rather than simply as an American. The problems with such tribal fissuring are threefold. One, the rhetorical disdain for traditional majority culture and values operates in a landscape in which the critic adopts the tropes and lifestyle of all that he demonizes. From what traditions do the Claremont or Berkeley students believe their rights of protest derive? Where do they get their expectations of clean campus water or capital to drop out of the economy for 4 years of college? Was the technology behind the iPhone a result of a patriarchal nativist male culture, and does that therefore make the device tainted and unsuitable for use? Well, of course not. Second, if red state, that's Republican, traditional America is constantly assaulted with various charges of isms and ologies, why would any foreigner wish to enter the United States, or upon entering live in such wretched places as red state Arizona, Texas, Florida, or Utah? Is schizophrenia thus required? Concretely use and enjoy the legacies of a demonized culture while abstractly condemning them. Third, when tribalism supersedes the individual, then all criteria of merit, character, and ethics recede into identity. Race, gender, and ethnicity replace merit as we begin to have black NSA engineers, white nuclear plant operators, or brown jet pilots rather than missiles, power, and flights that are overseen and operated by the most skilled among us. When a society operates on a tribal basis, we see it often in Africa and the Middle East. Everything from tap water to IVs are a luxury. I think this is a very, very poignant and pregnant warning. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to take a short musical interlude here, and want to play some music that I have been kind of concentrating on for the past few days, and it had to do with an anniversary that I didn't actually commemorate on the day it occurred, and that was the 12th of July, because that was a day we had a big kerfuffle here in Toronto over free speech, but and the memorial for Barbara Kalashka. However, the 12th of July was quite important in certainly in Anglo-Saxon history. It was the day in 1690 when William of Orange won the Battle of the Boyne and put an end to efforts by James II, who was a Catholic, to regain the throne of England. William of Orange, who was a homosexual dwarfish Dutchman, but a Protestant, decisively defeated the Catholic forces. And it led to permanently establishing the British crown as Protestant, but also entrenching in power in Northern Ireland the Protestant majority. And the conflict has remained a kind of an important conflict ever since. And this was the Battle of the Boyne was hailed as a great victory for Protestants over Catholics in Ireland at the time. An interesting side effect, or at least an interesting aspect of this, is that although it has been hailed actually as a victory for the Catholics, I'm sorry, for the Protestants, in fact, the Pope backed not Catholic James II, but William of Orange, for the sort of globalist reasons that I think sometimes frustrate people. James was backed by the Sun King, Louis XIV of France, who had grand designs on ruling much of Europe, and the Pope, wanting more of a balance, did not want that, and he backed the Protestant William of Orange. Anyway, here's a song celebrating the victory of the Battle of the Boyne, and it's called King Billy's on the Wall, and that refers to a famous a portrait on the walls in Londonderry. No, that's not the song we want. Here we are. Here we're hoping this we'll get this one. Here we are. Well, we are really having our problem tonight, aren't we? No, this is not the one we want either. We may end up with, here we are. Here we are, King Billy's on the Wall.
There's a famous picture that everybody knows. It stands apart on a gable wall over Sandy Road. In memory of King William and brother who did join. They fought for our deliverance at the Battle of the Boyne. King Billy's on the Wall. King Billy's on the Wall. He stands so high, shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the Wall. Well, there are slogans painted in red, white, and blue. They tell the Pope where he can go, what he can do. There's one big German rice, well that's a different class. Go stick the lower armor on and stick it up your ass. King Billy's on the Wall, King Billy's on the Wall. He stands so high, shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1619, King Billy's on the Wall. Well, the next time you're an oldster, won't you come and have a look? Stand beside that girl and have your foot in two. Then put it on your mantelpiece or hang it in your hall, so that all the world can see King Billy's on the Wall. King Billy's on the Wall. King Billy's on the Wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the Wall. King Billy's on the Wall. King Billy's on the Wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the Wall.
King lays on the wall, King lays on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King lays on the wall.
And that's King Billy's on the wall. Let's play a song we're going to play is this is an English. This is also celebrating. Well, that's the same song we play. We are having our problems tonight, aren't we? This is "Bury Me Under the Red Hand." The Red Hand is this is not the song I want to play. This is "Bury Me Under the Red Hand," which is there we are. And that's "Bury Me Under the Red Hand." Going to conclude this musical interlude with under an Ulsterman's command, and this is, that's right, under an Englishman's command, and this reflects the sense of betrayal that occurred in Ireland after the First World War.
Rightly proud of the land where they were born. I'll tell you of our volunteers and how it came to pass. As they went to fight for England's cause, far away from old Belfast, it was in the dark, uncertain days of early World War I, when England's shores were threatened by the jihad boot of the Hun. When England's cry for help was heard, we bid her not no fear, for at last the Flanders fields we will send our Ulster volunteers. It was at a place they call the Somme on the first day of July, when 20,000 Ulster men prepared to fight and die. Surely bravely high, with the cry of no surrender, boys, all those thirst battle cries. Now those Germans in their trenches deep could scarce believe they rise. We must uncharge those Ulster men and hear their battle cries. What kind of men are those, they said, who would leave their native land just to die upon this battlefield? And what is that strange red hand? Now on and on they fought that day, where others feared to tread. And on the wire and in the mud, they left behind their dead. But the only flag to fly that day behind those German lines was the old red hand of Ulster, with the shamrocks round her nine. Now those who lived came home again, what changes did they all find? For the counties that made Ulster up no longer numbered nine. Three counties had been sold away by those they fought to save. Was England's gratitude for the sacrifice they made. So gather round, my comrades, on this first of July morn, when Ulster men are rightly proud of a land where they were born. For they'll never more be led away to fight some foreign land, or to die for someone else's cause at an Englishman's command, or die for someone else's cause at an Englishman's command.
And that's at an Englishman's command. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on White Resistance Radio. Com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada and the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and of course, all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. What more do we have here? That's just a lot of interesting news coming our way these days, and a lot of great commentary going to take a look here. This is very, very bad news. The feds have just expanded civil asset forfeiture laws nationwide, and this is often used very, very arbitrarily against people who actually, at least in Canada, have not really committed a crime. They back a few years ago, there was a case where a man had rented his, I think, a basement to somebody in a suburb of Vancouver, who then used it. I think he had a few marijuana plants, and they charged the man who had marijuana plants, but he didn't. They also charged the owner, or they actually tried to seize the owner's house. And my good friend Doug Christie had to fight valiantly over several years to get it back. It's a very modest house. This is by Tyler Durden. When you're a government agency, asking for a tax increase is always a hassle. As Ryan McMacken notes, we're going to try to find where this sound is coming from. That's causing us this. We are really having our problems tonight, I'm afraid. This is about civil forfeiture. And I'm going to try to get that back up. I have to apologize for this. This is well, this is our Prime Minister, of course, running his mouth against these politicians are real traitors to the interests of Canadians. I'm not sure why this is. Let's see if we can't find out how to turn this thing off. I will probably have to deal with that item tomorrow. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of these are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.